Friday, Listen to Your Heart, sweet song by Swedish rock duo Roxette.
Released, Roxette, yeah.
Oh, Julia Hartley Moore, you're feeling it, aren't you? No? Not really.
I have to, don't I? I have to. Like, these songs, my God, they take you back.
Don't they? You know, Julia Hartley Moore in 88, where were you? Rocking some sort of dance floor somewhere. I bet you were. We all were.
Oh, I would have been. I would have been, for sure. But, crikey, yeah.
So, Per Gazell in Rock said, this is us trying to recreate that overblown American FM rock sound to the point where it becomes absurd. We wanted to see how far we could take it, and it blew up. A US number one. Roxette are Sweden's second best-selling music act after a band called ABBA. Never heard of them. Never heard of them. Johnny, not a bad power ballad, eh?
Not bad. I am familiar with the song, and I feel like on the panel tonight we're making people who aren't very old feel very old, because yeah. I wasn't actually around in 88 at all, and I only know that song because it's familiar.
I was in Nelson, Johnny.
Oh, there you go.
Having a dance at Limbo's nightclub, I think it was. 25-7 now. Loving your feedback. Changing careers. My career pivot, along with 4,000 others, COVID grounded my 22-year international flight attendant career. By that point, I was hyper-conscious of the climate problems emitted out the back of jet engines. So I pivoted into sustainability, and now I help companies and organizations reduce their climate impact, and it feels good. Having a job with purpose. Another one here, Sandra says, I changed from a physio to studying art and jewellery at Fitadea, now part of an amazing artist community. Another one here, I've done a slight career change. I've been a nanny for 18 years, travelling the globe, private jets, fancy restaurants, but I've recently changed my job and I started working at the Meatworks. So really,
wow.
Really amazing career pivots. What's yours? 2101. We are with Julia Hartley Moore and Johnny O'Donnell, and I'm loving your company this Friday evening. Time for I've Been Thinking. Julia Hartley Moore, take it away.
Well, honestly, I've got a problem here, and I'm hoping some of the listeners can actually help me out.
Tell the nation.
Pardon?
Tell the country.
I'm going to. I've got these doves, these spotted doves, quite a few of them on my property.
Mm-hmm.
And I notice that a lot of them, they appear to get very tired and then they die. And I don't know whether that's normal dove behaviour or there's something that they're eating here. Because you never, if you think about it, when do you ever see a dead bird unless it's squashed on the road, a pukeko or something, or a cat's chewed its head off? I mean, I'm sorry, but that's the fact. Mm. I don't see dead birds here, but the doves are worrying me. I want to know, what is it? Does anyone know what is causing them? They get really sleepy, and it's not just old ones, it's young ones, it's doves.
Oh, dear. This is a bit of a problem, and it could be quite a wee panel investigation. So you've got a few spotted doves on the property. You've noticed that they appear to get very docile, and they die.
Yeah. I mean, I can pick them up, Wallace. I can pick them up.
Oh, no.
I know, it's so horrible, and you can't do anything for them.
We might put you in touch with Birdcare Aotearoa, which is kind of our way near the Blockhouse Bay area. They are extraordinary with bird care. But if you do know what might be the issue, text me, please, 2101. You can email the panel at rnz.co.nz. Can you give the listeners a bit of a clue whereabouts you live?
Yes, I'm in Beechlands. I think we all know where I am by now, but I'm in Beechlands, and there seems to be a lot here. But I've got a lovely property with lots of trees, and I have noticed that the dove population has got a little bigger here. But I just don't know what's causing this, and it's been happening for quite some time now.
Okay, right. So spotted doves, they're getting docile and they're dying. 2101, why might that be? Beechlands in Auckland. Johnny O'Donnell, I've been thinking.
Docile and dying doves is a little bit of a tough segue for me here, but I've been thinking about the oceans lots recently. It's been a big theme of for the last few weeks for me, and the opportunities associated with the oceans for us as a country. It started last Saturday, where I was a part of the launch of the Hau Kōmaru Festival in Kaitiriti, which was the arrival of Waka Haurua and the sounds of Pumuana ringing out across the bay for the first time in 160 years or more in that space, which is an incredibly special moment for our region and for tangata whenua here. And then as part of some research that I've been involved in, I attended the Blue Economy Innovation Summit in Nelson yesterday, which was led by an organisation called Moana Nui. It was really, really interesting. What struck me is that I've always believed that if you throw a bunch of problems together, they tend to become easier to solve. And so I've been mulling over since the summit, you know, as a country right now, we need opportunities to get our mojo back. We need to lean into things that we do well, that make us unique. We need economic activity that restores our ecosystems, which we know are really sick. We need urgent and scalable action on climate change. And we really need to shift our focus to exporting knowledge, not just raw products. And there's this huge convergence of interest that I witnessed yesterday around a new blue economy. And it's a really big global opportunity that is being put into focus here in Te Tauihu. And I just plant the seed for listeners, because one of the big challenges is for us to fully kind of see and understand and recognize the opportunity for what it is. And the opportunity, I think, around restoring our ocean health, tackling climate change, creating high value exports, these are all things that can be delivered with a stronger oceans focus. I'll just finish that by sharing a standout stat that Volker Kuntz, the CEO of Cawthron Institute, shared recently. He said that Cawthron discovered that if we invested $1 billion into our oceans, we could turn Aotearoa into a climate-positive country in just one generation. So my call to action tonight would be, let's turn our attention there. Let's put the health of the moana at the centre, because everything we do from the top of the mountain to the bottom of the sea needs to reflect that in the desire for a healthier moana that can be a source of prosperity.
Kia ora, Johnny. Focusing on the blue economy. It is 6:42. Johnny O'Donnell and Julia Hartley Moore with me on the panel, RNZ National. By the way, we are on iHeart, we are on Spotify, we are on Apple, and of course RNZ. If you need to sit, or if you haven't managed to catch it up and actually want to go and listen at another time. But to this, OJ Simpson, the former NFL star and defendant in what was deemed the trial of the century, died today at the age of 76. We have all been talking, haven't we, in the offices, wherever, on the construction sites. Simpson was one of the most famous athletes in the US at his peak, winning the Heisman Trophy during his college days before rising to NFL fame. Then, 94, arrested as a suspect in the murder of his ex-wife Nicole Brown and her friend Ron Goldman. The trial captivated a nation and the world, and the debate over his acquittal has raged on since. It ushered in an era of rolling coverage, starting with those astonishing moments when OJ was running from justice in his infamous white Bronco.
911, what are you reporting?
This is AC. I have OJ in the car.
Okay, where are you?
Please, I'm coming up the 5 freeway.
Okay.
Right now, we're okay, but you got to tell the police to just back off. He's still alive, but he got a gun to his head.
And of course, nothing slowed down once he arrived in court, and his defence team, labelled the Dream Team, made quite a show of things, which all led to this iconic moment from lead defence attorney Johnny Cochran.
O.J. Simpson, in a knit cap, from two blocks away, is still O.J. Simpson. It's no disguise. It's no disguise. It makes no sense. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
I know, we all remember that. In 2008, Simpson was sentenced to 33 years in prison for armed robbery before being released in 2017. With me now, lawyer Michael Bott, to cast a legal lens over the case. Kia ora, Michael.
Kia ora, panel.
Was this a case that captivated legal minds? You have to say, I'm going to say it now, an extraordinary defence.
Oh, it was an extraordinary defence, but it was extraordinary times, and perhaps it still is. You've got to remember that in the minds of many black people in America, it's not unusual, basically, for rich white people who are guilty to go free every day. And you may recall, you may not, but I think it was around 1991, 1992, a jury of white jurors in Los Angeles acquitted Los Angeles Police Department officers from the recorded beating of an African-American man, Rodney King. Mm. And so it's against that background that we come to the O.J. Simpson trial. And he had a dream team, and the dream team used some of the prosecution material against them. For example, LAPD Detective Furman, for example, vowed and declared that he wasn't a racist, and yet OJ's lawyers produced transcripts and recordings of Furman using racist epithets in his witness interviews and things like that. And then you had the use of the glove, which Furman advised that he introduced or found without a warrant at the crime scene, and lo and behold, it didn't appear to fit. So this appeared to fit in many ways in the minds of many African Americans, with basically a racist system that was geared against black people. And so it's against that context, like in many ways we wouldn't understand that in New Zealand, but there is that long history. And you see it, for example, I think it was in 2012, a young African-American boy, Trayvon Martin, was just 17 years of age with his bag of Skittles, walking down the street. He was shot in the chest by George Zimmerman. And let stand your ground rules or laws over there. And the jury refused to acquit him. Refused to convict. It happens all, as I say, it's a completely different cultural context. And against that background, you have to look at it through the lens of the jury at the time.
Good. So good to get that context, Mark. Kia ora for that. Let's go around the panel and then come back to you. Johnny, can you recall any of this?
Yeah, I have to say I found the People vs. O.J. Simpson was actually it was a captivating series.
Wasn't it?
It was something that was very, I think it was very, very well done, actually, for all the reasons that Michael refers to. I think the nuances of the case were very, very well covered in that. I have to say I saw something earlier that I thought was worth mentioning, which is was a quote that said, "I guess O.J. Simpson can rest easy now knowing the real killer is dead." Because, of course, for so long he was campaigning around, I'm going to find this person, and that's what we're focused on. Just quite an extraordinary story, really. And I was thinking about what Michael was saying there around the race debate or the racial context that set the backdrop. But of course, this is different, but we're familiar with that here. And I think about the likes of Tana Porter and others who've had justice denied for similar reasons here in the country.
Michael, Julia.
No, I totally agree. And I think that's what you've got to remember. And I think it was the times in America. And I don't think that much has changed, to be fair. But you're right, Johnny, we have the same here. There's, I see it a lot that the more money you have, the more you can, justice you can afford, if you like. It shouldn't be that way, but it is that way. And But never having said that, I still think he was as guilty as hell.
Yeah.
OJ.
Michael, as a lawyer, do you want to offer an opinion on the panel about that?
Well, you look at the evidence and his history of spousal abuse and the call-outs and things like that. There are justifiable reasons to be concerned. But as I say, again, you've got to understand the particular cultural context. And it does seem to be, for example, with the current Trump trials, how the system appears to be bending over backwards for a rich, powerful white man who demonstrably has offended against, you know, the entire country in terms of the Constitution. Whereas if you're a poor African-American, you know, you just get ridden roughshod over, and it shouldn't be that way. And lamentably, often it appears to be the case. But as I say, it was interesting times, and as one of your panellists just said, sadly, it doesn't appear as though things have changed that much. There was a case recently in Texas, for example, where an African-American woman, on the advice of her parole officer, registered to vote a few years ago and did vote. She spent months in jail because of that, and yet the former president of the United States can do something that's so offensive against the Constitution. When the system treats them with kid gloves, there is a disparity. You can see it in the way that it impacts people of darker skin as opposed to white skin in the States. And sadly, sometimes you see the same thing here, and it's appalling.
Michael, pleasure to have you with us. Kia ora. That's Michael Bolt, their lawyer, who is casting a legal lens over that extraordinary piece of history, the trial of the century, and actually providing us some context into the times. Gosh, it's all coming back now. Rodney King, the race riots. Day's point of view is coming in here. I witnessed O.J. Simpson break the NFL rushing record in November of 74 against Joe Namath and the New York Jets at Shea Stadium. It was snowing at the time. My view is, as far as Nicole Brown goes, his ex-wife, he murdered her, full stop. We have had, by the way, Julia, a lot of response regarding your spotted doves. Many think it's a poison, poisoned with alpha-chlorolose, pissed off, a narcotic-based birth control agent. It slows their metabolism until they just stop breathing or die from hypothermia, says Peter. People are saying, yeah, if you have concerns, please do get in touch with Bird Care Aotearoa, as Wallace suggested. They're such a wonderful charity based in Green Bay. Good luck. I hope the doves get better, says B. It's 7:08. We have had such a response to this. Here's just another one in terms of career pivots. In case you're interested, I was first a trainee hotel manager for THC in the 70s, then a trainee chef, then a waiter, a sandwich bar proprietor, restaurateur, a journalist, and finally, a lawyer. And I do count myself lucky to have all these jobs and was never made redundant, so I'm quite lucky on that front too. And on that, with all the redundancies reported over the past couple of weeks, a large group of Kiwis will soon be on the job market. Making a major career pivot, not easy, but it's not impossible. Today, we are talking to one woman who did just that, a number of years working in the health sector as an occupational therapist. Rachel Coulson decided to switch gears completely. She is in New Plymouth. She's willing to talk to me now about what she pivoted to. Kia ora, Rachel.
Kia ora.
You did work in healthcare. What do you do? What do you do now?
I am the owner of a coffee caravan now in New Plymouth.
What's it called?
It's Sunny Coffee Caravan. Been going for about just over a year.
And how's it going?
It's going really well, yeah. I didn't have many expectations when I started. It was just a little bit of a pipe dream that I eventually started when I took a break from healthcare and slowly built it up to working full-time in it now. And as of next week, it'll be Monday to Friday, and yeah, it's going really well.
Oh, that's fantastic, Rachel. And we'll get the panel to jump in with a question, but healthcare, you know, a real calling for some, but why did you want to make the switch?
I guess I got to a stage of burnout for probably the second time in my career. I'd been in it for about 8 years. Still loved it, but I think staffing wise and coming out of COVID and having a bit of a sabbatical overseas and coming back to, I guess, the real world was a bit of a shock to the system. And yeah, I just got to the point of feeling like I needed a break and was lucky enough to land a job as a trainee barista at Ozone, which is a leading coffee roaster in New Plymouth. Yeah. And absolutely fell in love with the industry. I'd had a bit of a few holiday jobs as a kid in hospitality, but had never really loved it. But working in coffee was amazing. And I just got really inspired and decided to take the leap. It all kind of fell into place from there. And with the support of my family and Ozone and having a part-time job in healthcare as well alongside it, it all just kind of fell into place.
And now you've got your own small business, Sunny Coffee Caravan. Yeah. We've got another person lined up ready to go. We'll come to them very shortly. So just a comment from one of our panellists, Johnny.
Yeah, I mean, I can totally relate to this. I actually loved the quote that I saw from you, Rachel, around it feels like a choice, not a chore. And I was thinking it's a really interesting connection with healthcare because, of course, I think, you know, we're kind of underestimate what the people that we get coffee from and the people who look after us in hospitality actually do for us, because I think in a busy world that time to stop and connect with someone and the care that people in hospitality and the likes of the business that you're in, Rachel, that provide for people actually has some parallels with healthcare, doesn't it?
Totally. And that was the inspiration I think I had when I got to Ozone, was I was still able to make those really amazing connections with people and felt like I was still making a bit of a difference in someone's day, even if it was just for 5 minutes. And I feel like I've really created that in my own little business as well, which is awesome and feels a little bit more sustainable for me.
Oh, good on you, Rachel. And so you're going full-time next week, a year on, Sunny Coffee Caravan, after many years as an OT. All the very best for the future, Rachel.
Thank you so much.
All right, very good. And just a couple more responses on that. What else was there? Mike says, 2 years shepherding and farm managing change to communications infrastructure, data networks and phone systems. Now semi-retired, working 40 hours a week as a shepherd and renovating an old villa. Another one here says, I went from working as a journalist to being a landscaper. And with us now is Ellen. Welcome to the panel, Ellen.
Hi there, kia ora.
Now, so what did you change from and going to?
I used to be what was called an art specialist, working for auction houses based in London.
Wow.
And we would do sort of art acquisition, describing it, putting it into catalogue, and eventually selling it at auction. I was based in New Bond Street.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so they were quite interesting days, but as time went on, yeah, I realised it's not very fulfilling at the end of the day.
Okay, so you went going from selling high-end art at auction in London, and now what do you do?
And now I work for a little climate action network, the Albert Eden Climate Action Network, and I put on stalls with information on how the people of Albert Eden can be a little bit more climate friendly, reduce their carbon footprint by buying secondhand clothes and having their old electric items repaired and trying our e-bike that we have at our stall.
Well, Julia, what a career change that is, going from selling Monets and Frank Stellas to climate action, Julia Hartley-Moore. Yeah. What do you think?
You know what? The thing is, I think as long as you enjoy it, that's the key, isn't it, to most things? It really is.
And the big difference that it makes is that I'm working for something that actually is meaningful right now.
Yeah.
You know, that affects all of us and not just a few rich people who would like to adorn themselves.
Oh, come on. Yes. I bet you miss it.
Well, I miss the buzz, but the purpose makes you feel a lot better about yourself.
Yeah, Johnny?
Yeah, well, I can relate to all of these things, but I also feel incredibly lucky, and I'm sure lots of people who have been self-employed for a while, and particularly in the industry I'm in, will feel the same. I get to change jobs all the time. When you're on a project-based kind of work lifestyle, as I am with communications and strategy, my focus area changes every few months, really. And so I've only spent a couple of years in the workforce out of school before realizing I was totally unemployable, and I've been self-employed ever since.
And look at you
But
now.
I feel like, yeah, do a
It's
different
amazing.
job all the time.
Ellen, amazing story. And look, have a great weekend.
Thank you very much. I'll be at the Albert Eden, at the Mount Albert Library tomorrow if
Oh.
anybody wants to swing by and try our e-bike.
Oh, good on you. Oh, very, very good. I just see, actually, I've noticed it here, 11 a.m. until 1. There you go. Used to sell high-end art at auction in London and New York in the early 2000s. Now, Climate Action Network. And hey, wonderful panel, both Julia and Johnny. Have a great weekend, both of you. I'm Wallace
Thanks,
Chapman.
Wallace.
And stick around. I'm with you till 8 right here on RNZ National.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.